This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. And welcome to December, friends. Hope you're warm and safe and close to loved ones wherever you are. Owen Wolf is my technical producer. Ryan White is my live stream producer. And we are live streaming on the YouTube channel, Strange Planet Tonight. Open lines in the second half of the program. Your moment to shine, your moment to ask me, well, just about anything. You can talk about a recent paranormal encounter, UFO sighting, a conspiracy theory. Just do me a favor and bring your A material. That's in hour two, open lines. This hour, Paul L. Williams, PhD, investigates the true motives and consequences of the Pilgrim Society. Early members of the Pilgrim Society included J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, Andrew Mellon, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Paul Warburg, Mortimer Schiff, Otto Kahn, and John D. Rockefeller. Although the Pilgrim Society and the powerful men involved are often praised for their philanthropic actions, my guest tonight, Paul Williams, reveals that the society was self-serving and subjected the American people to a brutal system of economic tyranny, one which is still in place today. Paul Williams is a journalist and author. He served as a consultant for the FBI, editor and publisher of The Metro in Scranton, Pennsylvania, as well as an adjunct professor of humanities at the University of Scranton. He is the co-author or author of a number of books, including Osama's Revenge, The Next 9/11, The Vatican Exposed, Operation Gladio, The Killing of Uncle Sam, and his latest, co-authored by Rodney Howard Brown, is Killing the Planet, How a Financial Cartel Doomed Mankind. Paul, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Well, it's great to be back with you, Richard. Hope everything's okay with you up there in Canada.
Well, it's December, and accordingly, we're getting seasonal weather. We're getting the cold and the ice and the snow and so forth, but that's to be expected. I mean,
what happens to global warming? And we're going to be talking about that. Now it's climate change.
Of course.
And I understand
yes.
All the polar bears are happy. And
they are thriving. They are absolutely thriving. The polar bear population. Funny thing that, right? They don't talk about the polar bears anymore. They've gone the way of the hockey stick. Anyway, I want to delve into the Rockefeller family tree just for a minute here, because a lot of people, they're familiar with John D. Rockefeller. They're familiar with David Rockefeller, who lived to the ripe old age. I think he was 104 or something. But many people may not be familiar with John D. Rockefeller's father, who was a bit of a scoundrel, to say the least. Tell us about his dad.
Well, his dad was known as Devil Bill, and he passed himself off as a doctor, as somebody who could cure cancer. And he traveled throughout the southern states and the eastern states back in the 1840s and the 1850s. And once again, he peddled a cure for cancer. And he called himself Dr. William Livingston, and his real name was, of course, William Rockefeller. And he was a horse thief when he went to town and sold his snake oil. He would almost always steal a horse and hitch it to his carriage and head out of town. He was also a child molester. He was he was a bigamist. He was an all-around scoundrel, and he taught his sons how to cheat, and he was very proud of that. He said that I teach my sons how to cheat every chance I get, and how to make a crooked buck. And that lesson didn't was well received by his eldest son, John D. Rockefeller, who in the 1870s managed to gain control by crooked means of the oil industry. The oil industry, of course, was flourishing that time in Pennsylvania, Drake's Folly, they called it. And Rockefeller, by cooking a deal where he got control of all the refineries by making a deal with the railroad companies so that they were charging all the other people involved in the oil industry considerably more money to transport their oil than he had to he had to pay. He eventually gained control of all the oil refineries, and by the turn of the 20th century, he controlled 90% of all the oil in the United States.
But what was the oil being used for, Paul? Because the automobile was initially, I think, designed to run on ethanol.
Exactly.
When Henry Ford conceived the idea. So what was oil being used for back then primarily?
Well, really, when at first, that's why they said Drake's Folly, because when you're going back to the 1860s, and there was very little use for oil. The real worth of oil came about in about 1870, when it could be refined into kerosene and used to light lamps throughout the world.
Right.
This was, of course, before gas, and all the houses throughout the United States, because of the development of kerosene, were lit by oil. And what happened is when Henry Ford developed the cars, they were meant to. Ford said that the cars, the automobile industry, would be the greatest boon ever for farmers throughout the United States and Canada, because the cars would run on fermented vegetables, corn,
right,
wheat, any vegetable that you could ferment, apples, anything that you could ferment, you could use as fuel. And Ford always believed his cars were built to run on, you know, on ethanol. And what Rockefeller did, which was kind of ingenious, Rockefeller funded the prohibition movement to outlaw the sale of alcohol throughout and fermented substances throughout the United States. He funded that almost single-handedly. So what happened was that the farmers then, who were producing moonshine that could have fueled the cars, had to put poison in their ethanol, which made it unusable for automobiles. So John D. Rockefeller was very, very ingenious. And the entire oil industry was really developed by him. Think about this. Like, to this day, you know, almost everything is run. I mean, all the cars. And the number one fuel throughout the world remains oil. And that was really Rockefeller's ingenuity. But by the turn of the 20th century.
So without prohibition, excuse me, Paul, but this is important because this is something I hadn't really connected, which you just did so brilliantly. And that is, without prohibition, if prohibition hadn't happened, we'd be driving around cars fueled on ethanol.
Absolutely.
So did Absolutely. He bribe congressmen in order to bring in, what was that? Was that the 13th Amendment, the prohibition?
And what he did was even more ingenious. He didn't even work through the government. What he did was he worked through local temperance societies and through churches. He set up a foundation, and he would give these temperance leagues and people who were and church groups. He would give them incredible amounts of money to run a campaign so that alcohol would be outlawed. And he really did that from the grassroots. But the foundation, what happened was with the foundations that he set up, fueled the prohibition movement. It was totally Rockefeller.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Something I can't
believe. Right. How did
it came while we're writing Killing the Planet? But this guy was John D. Rockefeller. He not only created the oil industry and the natural gas industry, but he also funded the Russian Revolution. People aren't aware of that. He also was a main sponsor of socialism. He also gave rise to really the educational systems throughout the United States and Canada through his foundations. And that was all very ingenious because he could control education and by that, really control the minds of the people of North America simply by giving the colleges and universities incredible amounts of money. And the colleges and universities became completely reliant on his foundations to meet their expenses. As a matter of fact, to this day, and this is interesting, Richard, one-third of the budget of all the colleges and universities in the United States comes from foundations, largely the Rockefeller foundations. So they continue to control education.
Let me just back up a minute to the Russian Revolution. Why did he get behind the Bolsheviks? Why did he support the revolution?
Well, he always believed that competition was a sin, and he always wanted to be the sole provider of the commodity that he was invested in, whether it be natural gas or oil or later even banking. But socialism, even communism, suited his ends because socialism, he had the complete control of industry by the government. And that's all well and good, but the government still has to get money. And if he could control the money that's being provided to the government, he could control the whole nine yards. He realized that from the beginning. Trotsky, Leon Trotsky, as a matter of fact, before the Russian Revolution, was he was housed in a property owned by Standard Oil.
Aha! Uh-huh.
He was he was transported to Russia by the Rockefellers, and they also
fascinating.
They also after the turn of the century. Sponsor almost all the leading communist propaganda machines throughout North America, the newspapers, the periodicals, the radio programs.
Amazing. Now, Standard Oil, Teddy Roosevelt decided he wanted to bust up that monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work, though, exactly, did it? Why didn't it? Why
well,
not?
You see, that once again, you got a guy who's really... This is one thing. John D. Rockefeller, from the time he was born, and the Rockefellers to this day, they're born with the pathological fear of poverty, that they're going to lapse back into the state from which the great-great-grandfather, where he lived. And there's a pathological fear of, once again, of poverty. So they want to control everything. And they realized that they had to control, they wanted to control the government. They wanted to control education. When they developed petrochemicals, they found out a way to control the medical industry. So that to this day, the schools, the medical schools, receive most of their funding from the Rockefeller foundations. And the doctors are taught to deal in petrochemicals. Holistic doctors were put out of business, all by the Rockefellers. So even the drugs that people are taking for cancer, Chemotherapy is mustard gas. That's controlled by the Rockefeller family. The number one controllers of radium are the Rockefeller foundations and families. So when people are treated with radium, and when they're treated with chemotherapy, they're increasing the Rockefeller fortune.
Unbelievable. Do you have an estimated worth of the family right now?
The American Legal Association.
Right. I do want to get to that, but I just wanted to ask you about the do you have a handle on how much the estimated wealth of the Rockefeller family is at this point? Are we talking trillions?
Oh man, well, you got to realize that first of all, if Richard, and most people are unaware. We're not talking about conspiracy. This is all fact. The number one shareholder, the one who controls the one family that controls most of the shares of the Federal Reserve, is the Rockefeller family. Let's start with that.
Right.
So, look at their money is. Oh man, it goes into everything that you need in order for you to live, including even the green industries, all these, the food, Monsanto, all the food industries, the genetically modified organisms that constitute a lot of the food that we buy, all that comes from the Rockefellers. So How in the world can you estimate their wealth? You can look at one thing, at Chase Manhattan Bank. What is that worth? You know, you go from there to what are the various oil companies? You look at the different oil companies, Atlantic Richfield, Exxon. They're all owned by the Rockefellers. There's no
Rockefellers. I was mentioning Teddy Roosevelt. I was mentioning Teddy Roosevelt trying to smash the monopoly, but that's what happened. He just formed all these other little companies, right? He got around it.
That served him even the Rockefellers even to a greater extent.
I mentioned this to you last time we spoke, Paul, but I just wanted to mention it to my listeners on this this program. You were mentioning that, how the Rockefellers even get behind the green movement. And up here, of course, we have the oil sands out in Alberta. And they can't get their oil to market because they're landlocked. And we have a federal government that has not managed to build pipelines to the West Coast so that we could get that oil on tanker ships and over to overseas markets. So it's landlocked. And of course, the oil industry in Alberta has been vilified by all these environmental groups who insist on keeping the oil in the ground and so forth. Well, an investigator by the name of Vivian Krause out in Alberta did some heavy research. And who did she find was funding all of these environmental groups that was trying to keep Alberta oil in the ground? The Rockefeller Foundation.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely. And that there, you see that what's going to happen in the future, I believe, is that the world's money, which is based on nothing right now, it's not based on the gold standard, it's not based on even petrodollars anymore. It's going to be based on carbon emissions. Gore was aware of that. And there were different countries right now are dealing in trading rationing coupons for carbon, so that if a country can amass a great deal of these coupons, they're going to be able to use the most energy, and the other countries that don't have the rationing coupons will be relying on on people who hold the coupons for their existence. But we're seeing that take place right now. The future, once again, all the currency in the world will be based on carbon emissions. The Rockefellers are aware of that, so they're very heavily involved now in green energy.
They have us coming and going.
Involved right now in climate change and in different forms of in procedures, including HAARP, that can control the climate. So I mean, it's all everything that we do right now. This is what I found when I was doing the research for Killing the Planet. I think that the Rockefellers, what they started, what that family started during the 20th century, affects every single person on the globe right now.
Previously, we're just coming up to a break here, but I just wanted to mention, you know, previously after John D. Rockefeller, we had a number of the Rockefeller families that were sort of very highly, they were public figures. We had Nelson Rockefeller, of course, who was a vice president. We had Jay Rockefeller. We had David Rockefeller. They've all passed on. Who is sort of the face now of the Rockefeller family? We don't hear much about this person.
Well, I mean, there's so many different. You're now dealing with the fifth generation, people like Stephen Rockefeller, you know, Lawrence Rockefeller. I mean, Jay Rockefeller's sons, Jay Rockefeller Jr.
Right.
You know, John D. Rockefeller the fifth. You know, I mean, they're still around. The family is still, of course, very active and very much involved. But really, what they gave rise to was a machine, a huge corporate machine. I don't know who controls it right now, but it controls us. And
indeed,
that's the important thing, because it was all in the beginning about gain, about the putting an end to capitalism, about spreading socialism. And we're seeing it all come to fruition right now.
42% of millennials say they would like to live in a socialist country. That's scary. We'll take a time out. Paul L. Williams, PhD, journalist, author. His latest, co-authored by Rodney Howard Brown, is Killing the Planet, How a Financial Cartel Doomed Mankind. This is The Conspiracy Show. I'm Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
Keeping a watchful eye on the new world order. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. From Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome back. Killing the Planet, How a Financial Cartel Doomed Mankind. Co-author Paul L. Williams, PhD, is my guest for the hour. Coming up in the second hour, just a reminder, open lines. So have your stories, questions, queries, dissertations at the ready. You've got 35 minutes to practice in front of a mirror. You were mentioning the control of the education system. Are there Rockefeller subsidiaries that are responsible for writing the textbooks?
Oh, absolutely. The way that works is the foundations. Once again, the foundations were created. The Rockefeller foundations right before and during World War I. And what they did was they began providing an incredible amount of funding to colleges, small colleges and large colleges throughout Canada and throughout the United States. And what would happen is the colleges would receive these benefactions from the Rockefeller Foundation for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then finally, at the fourth year, when they applied for the funding, they wouldn't get it. And they would say, well, you know, what's the problem? We need the funding right now because we're relying on it. We build all these new buildings. We have a new faculty. We have expanded our faculty. We need the money. And the Rockefeller Foundation inevitably said, oh, yeah, but, you know, you will receive the funding, but we just need something in return. We just need you to change your curricula in certain areas. We need you to institute programs, not in history, but in social science. We need you to develop new courses in anthropology rather than religion or philosophy. We need you to change the head of your department here and there. We need to put a couple of members of our foundation on your board. And eventually what they did by that singular means is they gained control of all the colleges, the private colleges, and even the public institutions in North America. I saw it. It happened in seminaries. What they would do is they would fund seminaries, Princeton, Yale, Harvard, Drew, all, Union, all the leading seminaries. the seminaries would receive the funding year after year after year, and then the people from the Rockefeller Foundation would come in and say, oh, by the way, you know, you're putting too much emphasis in your courses on the supernatural, on the supernatural acts of Jesus, for instance. And we would prefer if you just concentrated on the social gospel. And, you know, we really think that, you know, if you start to develop the idea that the early Christians lived as communists, we would fund that course. And in that way, they gain control of all the university or the seminaries, and they really, in that way, by educating, in the sense of seminaries, are the way in which ministers were educated. They changed what was being preached from churches, you know, throughout North America.
That explains a lot, because I mentioned to you I grew up in the Methodist Church, the United Church now.
Oh, and the Methodist Church the Methodist seminaries, the leading Methodist seminaries, Duke, Drew, here in the United States, completely relying on the Rockefeller Foundation. I've seen that.
It makes a lot of sense now, Paul, because what has happening is, and I left the Methodist Church, the United Church. I grew up in it. It was wonderful. It instilled a wonderful sense of fellowship. It was a little weak on the worship side, but there was lots of fellowship. But what happened was you have all these United Church ministers now who are preaching, and there are a number of them that do not even subscribe to the divinity of Christ.
No, absolutely, Richard. I've seen it. I've seen people I've taught in seminaries throughout and I've seen people come in who are devout believers, fervently believe in Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus. I've seen within 1 week their faith shattered, and it's very easy. What the professors do is they'll say, well, the most important aspect of the life of Jesus is probably the resurrection. So look at the account in Matthew, and then they say, what do you see in Matthew? Who was the first one that appeared at the tomb? What time of day was it? What did that one person, who did that person tell about the resurrection? What did they do? And they put down exactly what happened in Matthew, what happened in Mark, what happened in Luke, and what happened in John. And then they'll be all written in front of the students, and they'll say, notice how every aspect of these stories conflict with one another. And that shows you that the event never occurred.
Mm-hmm. They're sowing the seeds of doubt.
And these people come out of seminaries, and once again, it serves the purpose of the foundation, because they're promoting globalism and a one-world religion, and this suits their needs. So that by the end of their seminary education, they'll believe that any form of worship is equally efficacious, equally meaningful, and that, you know, Christians have no real claim, exclusive claim on the truth. I've seen that. I've seen that time and time again. But it was all set. This entire strategy was set by the Rockefellers. It's nefarious, but I've seen it done.
To say the least. I would just want to back up a little bit and talk about the Pilgrim Society. And of course, the Rockefellers are central to that. But there were other families, you know, the Morgans and so forth. What was the purpose? I mean, ostensibly, it was to do philanthropic work. But what were they doing behind the scenes?
Let's just cut to where the Pilgrim Society came from. In 1887, Cecil John Rhodes formed the Society of the Elect, a secret society to promote global government under British rule. And he formed the Society of the Elect with Nathan Rothschild. And members of that society included the most influential people in England, Lord Reginald Brett, who was Queen Victoria's closest advisor, Lord Rosebery, who would become Britain's prime minister, Arthur Balfour, or Lord Balfour, who would also become a prime minister, William Stead, who is Britain's leading journalist, Alfred Milner, who would become governor of South Africa. These were members of, and the society of the elect wanted to take control first of, they wanted to take control of Africa. And they instituted the Second Boer War, which was very successful. They manipulated the whole thing. And the next step was to effect the reunion of the United States with Great Britain. That's what they wanted to do. And in order to do that, they morphed the members of the Society of the Elect, same people that we're talking about, except that Rhodes was dead. Rothschild, Nathan Rothschild, Rosebery, Brett, Balfour, Stead, Milner, all these same people formed the Pilgrim Society in London. They're going back in 1902. Within 6 months, they formed the Pilgrim Society in New York that met at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The members of the Pilgrim Society in London were the most powerful people in Britain. The members of the Pilgrim Society in New York were the most powerful people in America. J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, Cornelius Vanderbilt, William Howard Taft, who would become president shortly, Grover Cleveland, who was the former president, Paul Warburg of Kuhn Loeb, Nelson Aldrich, a senator, Mark Twain, John D. Rockefeller, Vincent Astor, yeah, the list goes on. But what they wanted to do is, number one thing, is they wanted to form an alliance between a new union between Great Britain and the United States. And the first step in doing that, these are the Pilgrims, was to create a central bank in the United States. And therefore, the same people that we're talking about are the people, the members of the Pilgrim Society, went to Jekyll Island and created the Federal Reserve System.
Right, that was rammed through Congress during the Christmas break when many members were absent. Most
right.
never even read the bill. Mark Twain, we're just about heading into the break here, but very quickly, did Mark Twain know the sort of this maybe the sinister motives, or was he just joining what he thought was a social club and something because he was interested in philanthropy?
So no, Mark Twain, if you read Letters from the Earth, was adamantly opposed to Christianity, adamantly opposed to America. Despite the fact that he wrote Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, he also wrote Innocence Abroad, in which, you know, he was a rabid Anglophile who wanted to bring about this union. He was not a red-blooded Yank.
All right, we'll step away momentarily, come back. More of my conversation with Dr. Paul Williams, the co-author of Killing the Planet. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Sarrett. Don't go away.
Where there's smoke, there's The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio.
We are back with Paul Williams, co-author of Killing the Planet. We're talking about the Rockefeller family, the Rockefeller foundations. There's a spider web of control, manipulation. And you were mentioning the attempt to essentially get the colony back under British control.
Right.
That Mad King George III had lost in 1776. And so if we look at history sort of through that lens, it's an attempt to get the colony back. I'm wondering about your thoughts. We just passed the 56th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. Some see that as a coup d'etat, an attempt to get the executive branch more firmly under control. Was that part of the Pilgrim? Was the Pilgrim Society involved? Were the Rockefellers involved?
Well, if you allow me to backtrack, when you know, so I can make that bridge.
Yes.
What happened with the Pilgrim Society, you're dealing with an organization that was created in 1903, and they brought about, they created the Federal Reserve System. They really instigated World War One, and at the end of World War One, they wanted to bring about the League of Nations so that a new global government. When that failed, the Pilgrim Society in London morphed into the Royal Institute of International Affairs, also known as the Chatham House. In the United States, the Pilgrim Society in New York morphed into the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations was controlled once again by these same, very same people, but the most powerful influence and the gatekeeper of the Council on Foreign Relations was John D. Rockefeller Jr. And that organization, from that organization, and once again, they, when you're dealing with, that was created in 1920, there were less than 200 members, and yet out of that organization, by 2019, the United States has witnessed from the Council on Foreign Relations 20 secretaries of state, 19 secretaries of defense, 21 CIA directors. Almost every chairman of the Federal Reserve has come from that same pool. The Council on Foreign Relations is organized the same way the Pilgrim Society was organized, as a circle within a circle. There's an inner nucleus that controls the whole thing, that prepares policy papers that are really eventually drafted into national policy and international policy. The CIA came from the Council on Foreign Relations, from the bowels of the United Nations, came from the Council on Foreign Relations. So what took place once that organization was created and began to amass more and more political and economic power, when you had a guy like Kennedy, who decided to take the control of the currency away from the Federal Reserve System and to place it under the Department of the Treasury, under government control, right after he announces his plans to do that, I mean, he's dead.
Well, right,
you have to look who are the shareholders of the who are the shareholders of the Federal Reserve at that time, the major shareholders. Also, who was controlling the State Department at that time? Who was controlling, you know, even who was controlling the press at that time? You see, I was a member of the press. I wrote for the leading newspapers in the United States. And if you wanted to get the inside news, Richard, you couldn't get it by, you know, talking to you or talking. This is in the day now. I'm 75, but as a journalist who was hired by leading news agencies, you had to go to the Pratt House in New York, the Council on Foreign Relations. You had to get entry in there in order to find out what was going on within the country, because all the rich and powerful industrialists, bankers, businessmen, politicians all gather there. If you didn't have entry to the Council on Foreign Relations, you didn't have a story. They control the press. They control what news was released, what was printed. The editors and the publishers of every leading newspaper in Canada, in the United States, was related to the Pratt House, to the Council on Foreign Relations. So you got to realize that they had that kind of power. So when compared with the power that this cartel has, the power of any president or any politician is minuscule. So
yes, yeah, he's a ceremonial ribbon cutter. By comparison.
I mean, they can overnight, all they need to do, just the shareholders of the Fed. Once again, look who owns the Fed. It's not the American people. It's owned by international bankers. If they want to bring about a depression, all they need to do is cut back in the money supply. It's very easy. And by the way, they did that. And that was an enormous benefit for the Rockefellers, the Great Depression. They engineered that whole thing. And at the end of the Great Depression, they could move in and buy the leading corporations in the United States for pennies on the dollar.
Right.
It all happened.
Right. You know, they own the entire monopoly board. One has to ask, you know, what's left? What's left for them to own?
You see it even in my industry. They control everything. Everything is consolidating now. Teddy Roosevelt busted the trust, but the trusts are back now. You got to realize that even in the publishing industry, in the day you had Bantam, Doubleday, Dell, Random House, Penguin, all these, they're all consolidated now. It's all one firm, one editorial board. and controlled by the same people. You see consolidation in everything. In everything.
All right. We'll take one final time out, come back, and finish up with Paul L. Williams, the co-author of Killing the Planet. We'll talk about David Rockefeller. Did you know, this is something I've heard, dear listener, that when the Queen would make an official visit to the United States, she wouldn't visit the president first. First, she would visit David Rockefeller. At least that's what I've been told. We'll get Paul Williams to confirm or deny on the other side. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away.
The world is being pulled over your eyes. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio. To reach Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
We are back with Paul L. Williams, PhD, and the co-author of Killing the Planet. I mentioned that that legend going into the break. I've heard that repeatedly. Is it true that when the Queen of England would come to the United States, her first visit would be to see David Rockefeller? Have you heard that?
I have heard that, and I believe that, and I'm going to tell you why. David Rockefeller was the founder of the Bilderberg Group, which was established in 1954. The Bilderberg Group, the purpose of the Bilderberg Group was to unite all the world into one economic entity, and especially to create Eurasia. A leading member of the Bilderberg Group, almost from the get-go, is Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth. So they are so tight with the Rockefellers that you know they're as close as any people on the planet can be. So I would say absolutely, if he was visiting the United States, he would immediately stop at Rockefeller Center and visit David Rockefeller, or Chase Manhattan Bank and visit David Rockefeller.
There's another story I've been told. This comes from, among others, Daniel Estulin, who has written extensively about the Bilderbergs. And he talks about a Bilderberg meeting in 1991, where a young Arkansas governor, former Arkansas governor, Bill Clinton, was in attendance.
Right.
Bill Clinton was introduced to David Rockefeller.
Right.
David Rockefeller proceeded to give William Jefferson Clinton sort of a master's class on globalism,
right,
after which he asked Clinton, "Do you agree or disagree?" He said, "I'm all in." And Rockefeller supposedly extended his hand and said, "Congratulations, Mr. President." Is that apocryphal? Is that true?
Oh, that, look, the absolutely. I mean, they have controlled almost every election that we've had in the United States. They control education. They control the Supreme Court. They control people listening to this would think this is really crazy. But look at money controls everything. If you want to understand it, if you want to understand a development, you always have to follow the money. And the money inevitably leads back to the Rockefeller family. So,
right.
Yes. The relationship between the Clintons, the Bushes, the Obama and even Trump with the Rockefellers is very, very deep.
Is there a countervailing force? Is there a dynasty in opposition to the Rockefellers they're sort of the two are battling behind the scenes, and occasionally it kind of spills out onto the main stage?
No, what you had was in 1998, you had the merger of Amoco with BP. That represented probably the most significant, one of the most significant developments of the 20th century. That was the merger of the Rothschilds with the Rockefellers, Amoco with BP, and that merger took place because really the Rockefellers became infinitely more powerful. the United States became infinitely more powerful than Great Britain.
Right. Now, on the surface, Trump seems to be the antithesis of what the Pilgrim Society and the Rockefellers want. He talks about America first. He talks about tariffs. He talks about borders. He talks about the nation state. Well, and you look at who stands in opposition.
They're done away with. The Rex Tillerson, who was his first Secretary of State, was a, of course, before he was appointed, was the executive director of Exxon. You see things that are promised that are never delivered. You know, we're going to build a wall, we're going to do this, we're going to pull out of the endless wars, and yet the endless wars go on. I'm going to take control of the CIA, and yet the CIA is still under the control of, you know, the money cartel. Richard, I had some hope in my life for a real change, but that change hasn't taken place. I mean, there's a lot right now of a resurgence of nationalism, but no real change.
How do we fight back, or is it too late?
The forces are all pushing toward a global government. We're seeing more and more that coming to fruition. And I see it with the laws concerning climate change, for instance, are now being imposed on all nations. You see organizations like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And how do you combat all that? How do you combat all that? How do you combat the globalization of poverty that's taking place in Canada and the United States? We're saying, yes, it is, because the industries are going to the third world. How do you combat that? How do you combat the endless wars that are going on and on and on and have gone on for generations that really have no people even know that they were created by false flags, by bogus news, and yet nobody cries out against it.
It sounds like they have everything locked down. Is there any hope here, Paul?
Change at all? I think that the first way that hope could be if we could get control of education, where people are really learning something. If people, believers, could take control of their churches. If local people on the like you and people that get involved in Canadian politics that believe and that know that's exactly what's taking place, if they would do that, if they would engage, yeah, that's where the hope is. But the hope is not with the people who are funded to run for office.
And boy, that sounds like a pretty daunting, almost impossible task.
PACs or... So yeah, that is the only hope. You get a show like this where we're talking, and a lot of people will just dismiss this, but some people might actually pick up a copy of that book. I'm not making a dime on the book, by the way. All the proceeds go to the River School of Government. But if they could just get a copy of the book and read it and find out what's going on and saying, I'm going to change this locally, that's where it starts.
Right. Killing the planet. You mentioned, you know, people might sit back and say, well, this is too unbelievable. Talk to me about the documentation, the amount of footnoting you've done here.
To write a book like this, I can't even tell you. I'm an obsessive compulsive. So I will work maybe 16 hours a day. And when I don't sleep. So I go through there's over 1,500 footnotes in that book, and they're all to primary sources. At the end of the book of Killing the Planet is a classified CIA document. I thought I'd be arrested by now. There's a classified CIA document at the end of that should drop the scales from anyone's eyes at the end of that book.
Wow. And also people should understand, you know, you just can't put a book out there that's just filled with innuendo and speculation, you have to have a book like that lawyered, right?
Well, first of all, I mean, I've been sued. I've been sued in Canada and I prevailed. I was sued by a leading figures in Canada. I don't know if you're aware of this, Richard. I was sued for $12 million.
But at McMaster University, wasn't it?
Yeah. And look, I don't have anything. I mean, I used all my funds. When they came after me, I said, hell no, I'm going to fight back. And I did, and I prevailed. And if I could do that, you know, then, you know, I mean, a lot, there still is hope. But, yeah, in a book like this, you have to have all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed, because you're going against people with a great deal of money who could crush you. You know, you have to be prepared for that. So the book has to be very well documented. I mean, everything has to be documented. Every sentence has to be documented. And it has to be very well vetted. Then you have to have
How do folks get a hold of a copy of Killing the Planet, Paul?
Oh, you could get it from any book, you know, major book outlet, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. What's the huge book outlet?
Indigo.
Yeah, Indigo, right. But, you know, it'll be available anywhere.
All right, and we've linked up to that at strangeplanet.ca. If you want to just click on the book title, I think that links up to Amazon.
I leave you, is how important a show like yours is. There are very few and far between. There are very few hosts who are as well-educated, well-informed as you are. And I've been on hundreds and hundreds of shows, and this show is very important. And
Paul, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. And it's always a delight. Let's talk again soon.
Okay, my friend.
Paul thank L. You. Williams, Killing the Planet. All right, when we come back, open lines. We'll roll out those numbers in just a moment. I'll be waiting for your call right here on The Conspiracy Show.
Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
Well, thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Howdy to each and every one of you listening in on our flagship station, AM 740 and 96.7 FM, Zoomer Radio here in Toronto. Hiya to those tuning in on one of our affiliate stations across North America, those streaming us on the Zoomer Radio app, those streaming us on our YouTube channel, Strange Planet, those of you in the YouTube live chat who join us every week without fail, those who catch this show as a podcast, which is available wherever fine podcasts are found. However, and wherever you're listening, I bid thee the warmest of welcomes, and I thank you for your fine company. Open lines this hour, and I've said it many times, we don't get to do open lines nearly enough, but tonight is the night. Yes, indeed. Just you, me, and the telephone, friends. And I am game for just about anything, keeping in mind this is The Conspiracy Show, so I'm not going to entertain calls about sports. I do love to talk political intrigue and subterfuge backstage in the global theater, as my good friend media scientist Nelson Thal likes to call it. I'm also receptive to calls about the strange and the unexplained. If you have a story you think might raise the hackles on the back of my neck, well, then I am all ears. Yes, indeed. So, let me give you the numbers in the Greater Toronto Area. You will dial 416-360-0740. Again, this is in the Greater Toronto Area. 416-360-0740. And if you're anyplace else, just about any place else on the planet, then you will use this number. It's toll-free, 1-866-740-4740, 1-866-740-4740. Now, while I'm waiting for the phone lines to fill up, this would be a good time to give you a heads up on next week's program. Next week, of course, the second Sunday of the month. And that means a visit from one of our relatively new regular contributors, the discoverer of reverse speech, David John Oates, will be here. He joins us in the first half of the first hour, the first segment, really. And he'll bring along some more reversals live from his home in Australia. And I have to tell you, I'm getting a lot of emails from listeners about this segment. Excuse me. It would appear, based on the voluminous mail, that many, many, many of you are enjoying these reversals. In fact, this past week, I posted to my various social media platforms a link to a recent episode of David's podcast, Reverse Speech Radio. And the episode features reverse speech of serial killer Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, serial killer. And boy, did I get a big response from that. People are finding that particular episode of Reverse Speech Radio, listening to it, and are just amazed, shocked, and so forth, what they're hearing. In fact, Reverse Speech Radio, they've done an entire series on various serial killers, John Wayne Gacy, and other, well, Jimmy Savile, of course, the pedophile from the United Kingdom, Jeffrey Epstein, on and on it goes. So David John Oates joins us next Sunday in the first hour. I'm not sure what he's bringing along. Last month, he brought along some amazing reversals from our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. So we will see what's in his bag of tricks next week. Also next week, Don Jeffries, the author of Hidden History, and his newest book, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. He will return to the program. We've been kind of slowly working through our way through his book. It's a hefty tome, I have to tell you. Well, you can imagine, nearly 300 years of history. And he's been on this program. He's also been on my podcast. And as I say, we're kind of slowly working our way through it. So, Don, if we could do a show once a week, every week with Don Jeffries on this book, we would fill up at easily a year's worth of shows. Anyway, we'll cram as much as we can into about 90 minutes. Don Jeffries, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. That's next week. And then the following week, Thomas Horn, longtime author, broadcaster, the CEO of Skywatch TV. He's a publisher. You may be familiar with Defender Press. Now Thomas Horn was originally scheduled to be on for tonight for 2 hours, but he had to reschedule on his end. And so he's scheduled for 2 weeks from tonight, and we'll discuss his new book, Thomas Horn's new book that is causing quite a storm, The Wormwood Prophecy, NASA, Donald Trump, and a Cosmic Cover-Up of End Time Proportions. That's quite a title, The Wormwood Prophecy. That's Thomas Horn coming up in 2 weeks. All right, let us launch into 55 minutes of open lines, and we will begin with Bonnie from Mississauga. Good evening, good morning, Bonnie. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well for 87 years old, who never misses your program.
God bless you.
I might not understand the subject matter, but I still listen and hope for the best, you know.
But, oh, God bless you. Thank you.
Okay. I'm very nervous, so forgive me if I start to stammer.
Bonnie, you don't need to be nervous.
400 VCSs. And there was many movies in there, but there were some tape documentaries, and one was called The Blair Witch Project. Have you heard of that one back in 1994?
Well, yes, I remember going to see that. It was a work of fiction. It was supposed to look like a documentary, but it wasn't really. Yeah, they made it look like a documentary, but it's more what they call I don't know what the word for that is. It's not a mockumentary, but it's a faux documentary. It's shot in a particular style, and they make it, I mean, it was very convincing. You're right.
Oh,
it was very convincing.
Gracious, because I still wanted to know if they ever found anything about that project.
So you watched that at home, did you? Or
no, I watched it on some kind of a documentary that had been taped by the person who gave me all these
I see.
Things.
Okay.
So it wasn't for real then. Okay, well, thank you.
Well, that's all right. That one wasn't particularly for real. But, you know, who knows, you know, Bonnie, that there may be others. Obviously, there are many, many strange and unexplained things that happen to people alone in the woods at night. You can well imagine.
Oh, yes. Well, anyway, I appreciate your taking the time to take the call. And I'm wishing you and your family the best of everything in the new year and a Merry Christmas and all that jazz.
Merry Christmas and all that jazz. God bless you, Bonnie, 87 years young and listens every week. Thank you so much for your support. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much again. Right. Bye-bye.
All right. You have a good night. God bless her. James from Toronto is joining us. James, good morning. Welcome to the Conspiracy Show.
Thank you, Mr. Serrett. You know, E.T. might be responsible for creating us almost 13.5 or 13 or 14 billion years ago, some might think, right?
That's one theory, yes.
Yeah, that's a possible theory. And there are other possible theories, but I was just pondering this while I was listening to you. And the Earth is about, what, 4 billion years old?
On the order of 4 or 4.5 billion, correct.
Billion, I guess, or 500 million. But the universe, I'm talking more specifically about the universe. Now, if E.T. were responsible for the creation of the Big Bang way back then, I was thinking 15 billion years or 13.5 billion years, that's a long time. You would think,
yes.
You would think that they might be long gone. Dead, gone. Because I know the human race is not going to last 13 billion years. They're not going to even last maybe 1,000 years or 10,000 years. So 13 billion years, I doubt if the possibility that E.T. created us, they're not around no more. We're alone. We're alone.
Well, I happen to believe we are alone, at least in this dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't curry me much favor with the UFO community.
That's right.
Now,
too.
Something you said is interesting, that, you know, if they created us,
right,
and then who created them?
That's true.
You see, so that doesn't, you know, rule out the existence of a higher being.
Well,
and aliens, I mean, if they created the universe, that means that they exist outside of time and space.
That's true.
Which means that they are not physical entities. They are not extraterrestrials. They would have to be considered interdimensionals,
so
which is more along the lines of my thinking. I think the pilots of these craft, if we're not talking about, you know, a special access program, a black op, a sophisticated piece of aircraft that was made by human hands, which I think accounts for about 90% of the sightings these days, including these large triangular craft. If we're not talking about those, I think what's piloting these UFOs, these unidentified aerial phenomena, I think they're interdimensionals.
There could be from another dimension.
But yes, like the angelic realm, perhaps.
Maybe, but I think those ETs that might have created us 15 or 13.5 billion years ago from the Big Bang mm-hmm. theory, they could be completely gone. But there might be other ones out there. But, you know, that's what I was thinking about that when I was listening to you. That could be a possibility.
Right. Sure, sure. I mean, if you consider that if there were other life forms, sentient, rational life forms in the universe, intelligence, in other words,
yep.
the odds that their civilization would coincide with ours, I mean, we have existed but the wink of an eye in cosmic terms. So you're right, if they are.
I think I was listening to a show and they were saying that we're only like 3 seconds into the whole expansion of the universe. Like the whole universe is like 90 billion years, light years across. And I heard someone mention that we're only like 3 seconds into that time period.
Yeah, that sounds pretty reasonable.
You know, 3 seconds.
Not much.
3 tiny seconds. I enjoy your show, Richard. I listen to you every Sunday and it's even a greater pleasure when I can hear you on coast. So.
Ah, well, thank you very much, James.
Both, man. Take care, man. Bye.
Good to hear from you. I'll be back in the Coast Air Chair Saturday, December the 8th, and Saturday, December 7th, and Sunday, December the 8th. Come to think of it, both big anniversaries. The 7th, of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor. That would be the 78th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. And December 8th, of course, will be the 39th anniversary of the murder of John Lennon. All right. Let's see. Who do we have next? We have, is it Maureen from Barrie? Is it Maureen?
Yeah, it is.
Hey, Maureen, welcome aboard. How are you?
Okay. Last time I spoke to you, it was kind of something weird, and something weird again. But I have had dreams where they are so real that you swear you're living them. And it isn't until you wake up that you realize, no, this didn't really happen, eh? Now, a couple of weeks ago, I fell asleep, and I was woken up with the ringing of my phone. Well, I live in the basement apartment, and, you know, the other tenants and that, if they figure them out, they have no problems with coming down into my place and that. But anyhow, as I'm fiddling around trying to find my phone and that to answer it, I see someone come down the stairs and head into my bathroom. So I finally get the phone, and the phone hasn't rang. There was no call, no activity on the phone for like 2 days. So I get up, and I'm not as scared as I am perturbed that someone's snooping around downstairs, eh? Go into the bathroom, there's no one there. And there's no way for them to get out of the bathroom without my seeing them.
Right. So the phone didn't ring, and there was no one in your apartment.
Yeah, nothing, eh? And yet,
so you.
It was like, so you, I don't remember
so
waking up. That's the big part. Like, I mean, usually when I have one of those dreams, I know when I'm awake.
Right.
And this time I didn't. It's just like, just carrying on. Either it was all reality or all been a dream for the last couple of weeks or something.
Right. Dreams are funny things, aren't they? Especially
yeah.
when you do something called lucid dreaming. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of lucid dreaming?
Yeah.
A lucid dream, yeah, it seems so real. And it's almost like you can take control of your dream. And I've had a couple lucid dreams, not very often.
Not common with me, but
I've also had dreams where I have memories, in fact. I have memories. I wonder if this has happened to you, Maureen. You get to a certain age, and I can no longer remember whether it's an actual memory or it's something that I dreamt. Has that happened to you?
There are things that I wonder about. As I said, this was only a couple of weeks ago that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
As I said, it's just odd that I don't remember waking up. Like, I mean, as I said, I've had lucid dreams before. And when I wake up, I realize, okay, yeah, that dream was scary because it was so real. But this one,
right.
I don't even remember waking up. Like, it's just.
But isn't it odd that the incident, it coincided, you thought the phone rang, and then there was someone in the apartment. It's almost like the phone was ringing to warn you.
Yeah. And yet, as I said, there was no phone call, and there was no one in my apartment.
Hmm. All right, Maureen, next time you have one of those strange dreams, you give me a call, okay?
Yeah. I'll let you know.
All right. Hey, sweet dreams. Have a nice dream tonight.
Yeah, and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you. God bless you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. I hope Maureen has a dream where she's got a nice one of those fruity drinks with the umbrella in it, you know, a nice cocktail, and she's in a chaise longue somewhere in a nice stretch of white sand overlooking a tropical sea, turquoise. She looks down into the water, and she can see starfish and sea turtles. It's a gentle breeze, maybe the slight scent of jasmine in the air. That's the kind of dream I want Maureen from Barrie to have tonight. Let's say hi to Gary here in Toronto. Gary,
yes,
welcome aboard, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. First of all, Richard, I wanted to thank you. I've sent you emails asking for information about shows, and you've been very prompt with your replies, and I really appreciate that.
Oh, well, I aim to please, sir. Sometimes I get buried underneath the emails, and there's no climbing out, but I do the best I can. So
yeah,
I'm glad I was able to help you out.
I'm glad for that. Now, your screener condensed it down to fake news, but basically what it is just the frustration that I find, and I'm sure a lot of listeners to your show have found, when you cite facts to people, like, for instance, Paul Williams cited, he has all those footnotes, and you check them in cite facts, and you still have people who dismiss it as, well, it's not true. Like, for instance, the Federal Reserve being privately owned. I have people right. I talk to, and they say, no, it's government. I said, no, it's not. And I just wanted to express that. You must find the same thing then, because sometimes when you're talking to people, they dismiss facts as conspiracy.
Sure. That's the way that term is being used now. It's a cudgel to beat down someone, metaphorically speaking, of course. At least I hope it's metaphorical.
Right.
Yeah. To stifle debate. Well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. Well, why do people believe in conspiracies? Because conspiracies actually happen from time to time. True. That's why.
That's correct. And that's the problem is that once you dismiss it as conspiracy theorist, then there's no more investigation on their part. They just dismiss it. And I guess I'm losing faith in the abilities of human beings to reason, because I find, the ad hominem argument is used, dismisses a conspiracy theorist, or they want to believe what they want to believe, and it doesn't matter, what facts you present to them. And I find that pretty frustrating. That's all. That's basically.
Well, people that are asleep, sometimes it's best not to try and wake them. They used to say that about sleepwalkers. If you try to wake them, it may not end well. So maybe that's the lesson. What's that line Jesus said? To his disciples as he sent them out into the world. If they don't want to hear the message, just wipe the sand from your feet and keep on moving. Like, just get up and walk away.
I guess when I was listening to Paul Williams, I was thinking there, I wonder if there is any hope, because when you try to wake people up, they don't want to be woken up. And, it makes me wonder, how are we going to, bring awareness? Where the people just want to go to work, come home and cook their dinner and watch sports. And that's it.
Because everything here is temporal. The earth, this is ephemeral. And as a Christian, I believe that ultimately, good wins out in the end. And, we may not see it played out here on earth necessarily, in our lifetime, but ultimately the good will triumph over evil. And that's what we're talking about here, really, is evil. That's the ultimate conspiracy, right? And who is really running the world? And I think it's Satan. I think it is. He works through different people and different systems.
Right.
But listen, I want to thank you for calling, Gary. I hope you'll call again sometime. We have to do open lines more often.
Okay.
We'll take a quick time out, come back, more calls await as we head on into the second half of our open line section right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett.
Big Brother is listening, and so are you, to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Welcome back. Just a reminder, I have a newsletter now. It's a free monthly newsletter, and it's called Inner Sanctum. And it's real easy to subscribe. All you need to do is register at my website. If you go to strangeplanet.ca, you can do it right now. It'll take but a few seconds. Once you're on the website, you'll notice at the top under the banner, in large blue letters, it just says, sign up for my newsletter. Just click on that, enter your name, first name, last name, and your email address. And then bingo bango, every month you'll start receiving Inner Sanctum. Once a month, it'll arrive right in your email inbox. It's absolutely free. And again, all you need to do is register. Now, the bonus is once you register for the newsletter that you'll get, and December's issue is just days away. So if you haven't signed up yet, you've missed October, November, but you can still get on board now for the December issue before that goes out, strangeplanet.ca. And then in addition to getting the free newsletter, you'll also be automatically entered into the draw for, it's a monthly draw for Strange Planet gear, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, socks, phone cases, tote bags, and more, and really cool designs. In fact, if you go to the bottom of the strangeplanet.ca website, you'll see a button for my store. You can click on that. So again, sign up. It's quick. It's easy. You get the newsletter for free, and you get a chance to win some really cool Strange Planet merch. All right. Before we head back to open lines, and thank you for those waiting on the line and being patient, I saw this story. This is amazing. Out of China, Reuters is reporting that China is aiming to complete and start generating power from an experimental nuclear fusion reactor by around 2040. Nuclear fusion, folks, we're talking about, it's like harnessing the power of the sun. We're not talking nuclear fission, which is the current mode of producing nuclear energy. A senior scientist involved in the project said, as it works to develop and commercialize a game-changing source of clean energy, China is preparing to restart its stalled domestic nuclear reactor program after a three-year moratorium on new approvals, but at a state laboratory in the city of Hefei, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, or Hefei, in China's Anhui province, scientists are looking beyond crude atom splitting in order to pursue nuclear fusion, where power is generated by combining nuclei together, an endeavor likened by skeptics to putting the sun in a box. While nuclear fusion could revolutionize energy production with pilot projects targeting energy output at 10 times the input, think about that. Energy output, 10 times the input. That's what we call over unity, folks. No fusion project has up to now created a net energy increase. Critics say commercially viable fusion remains 50 years in the future. China has already spent around 6 billion yuan, or $893 million, on a large donut-shaped installation known as a tokamak, which uses extremely high temperatures to boil hydrogen isotopes into a plasma, fusing them together and releasing energy. If that energy can be utilized, it will require only tiny amounts of fuel and create virtually no radioactive waste. Okay, well, we will track that with interest. Nuclear fusion. That would definitely be a game changer. All right, let's say hi to, here's another guy, James from Toronto. Hello, James. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Long time listener, first time caller.
Welcome aboard.
I'm not going to really detail it too much, but it concerns the correctional system in Toronto.
All right, the Toronto City Jail?
Toronto South, sir.
Okay.
And I have a thing called an intermittent sentence. And
all right.
I have to go to over the weekends. But when I get there, I get treated unfairly.
How do you mean?
They treat me like I have court or something the next day.
I don't follow. What do you mean they treat you like you have court? What does that mean?
Well, but basically it means like I go there and then they wake me up. I only get like 4 hours, if I'm lucky, of sleep. And then they wake me up, and then they give me this orange jacket and stuff like that to wear, and
well,
they just send me off the court.
That's traditional prison garb, is it not?
Well, I understand that, sir, but then I've heard people tell me that they go to court at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they don't get back till 10 o'clock at night.
All right, but that's not happening to you. You're not going to court. You've already been tried and sentenced, right? And you're serving weekends.
Yes, sir.
Now, I don't know what you did. I don't need to know what you did, James. But the fact that you're serving your sentence on weekends seems to me to be a pretty good shake. That's not something that is afforded to most convicted criminals, as far as I know. I don't know what's going on with them waking you up at, did you say 4 in the morning?
About that, yes, sir.
Right. Not sure what's going on there. But aside from that,
I also have a question, sir.
Okay.
I heard that the Ontario government, like, because I know like how prisons are privatized and stuff like that, but the Ontario government makes $80 off of each inmate every day.
Never heard that before, and our prisons aren't privatized here, as far as I know. I know they are in the United States to a certain extent, but not here. In fact, you're costing the taxpayer a considerable amount of money, I would think. So, no. I unless someone can show me documents proving otherwise, I would have to say that's not true. James, thank you for the call, and all the best.
Thank you very much, sir. My mom said hi, by the way.
Well, you say hello and Merry Christmas right back.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. All right. God bless. Okay. Let's see. Do we have time for one more? We've got 2 minutes. I'm kind of betwixt and between. What do you think, Owen? Do you want to buzz me in the ear? Do I have time for another one? Let's do a quick one, he says. Well, Owen's the boss, so let's do it. Melanie's in Toronto. Lots of calls from Toronto.
Hi, wishing everybody a blessed Christmas and a happy New Year's while I still have time on the phone. This man just jotted my memory about something that I'm aware of, but I just wanted to call and say we shouldn't be afraid of aliens or nuclear fission or whatever that'll kill us. What's going to kill us is the collapse of our institutions because trust is being lost in them. And if we lose trust in our institutions, people become depressed. We know depression is a very big thing in around the world because people have lost their hope. When you can't trust your government, you can't trust to get justice, you can't trust, and sometimes people are dismissed when they, like you said, conspiracy. They're not conspiracies, they're insights, which I believe some want to label that. But just to let you know, I'm a senior citizen from the East Bloc originally, from Ukraine. And I just want to let you know, I never thought that I would see in this country the injustice and experience the lack of concern for people. You know where money is wasted in our economy? It's not even the jails. It's police officers who are wonderful and they're great. But then there are those who are not and who do false arrests. The money that it costs to arrest somebody falsely out of vengeance, out of anger, out of abuse, out of ignorance, and then having to put them through the court system. That's what we have to investigate. How many arrests are made frivolously, which then end up in court wasting even thousands of dollars? And, you know, and it needed not be. That needed not to happen. So we wasted $100,000 on false arrests. Now, that's something that you could inquire and find out, whether it's in the news programs or investigative journalism. How much money is wasted on false arrests where people are proven innocent just to keep the numbers going with the arrests and keep the coffers filled?
It's a good question. I don't know. I've got to run here, Melanie.
I can tell you a personal story that would shock you.
Another time, we'll have to do that.
Another time, not now. No, maybe in an email.
All right, got to run. Thank you, Melanie. God bless. Merry Christmas.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I don't know what the data is. I haven't seen any data. False arrests? Who's to say? Does it happen? Absolutely. Is it the norm? By no means. Anyway, we'll... We'll get to Phil from West Virginia when we come back. What's on Phil's mind? We shall find out when the Conspiracy Show continues.
PIN numbers, passcodes, social insurance numbers. If they make you wonder how private they are, here's two more numbers. 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Welcome back. You're still up. Thanks for the company. We had an earlier caller wondering about what to do about the state of the world and how, according to Paul Williams, our guest in the first hour, the elites, the powers that be, the Rockefellers, if we're going to name them, the Rockefellers have everything locked down. They own the monopoly board. We are nothing but useless eaters. What can we do? How can we fight back? And I've been sitting here thinking about that, and a song popped into my head. I played it the other night. Bumper music on Coast to Coast. Willie Nelson's son. Is it Lucas Nelson and the Promise of the Real? That's his band. If you've never heard them, Lucas sounds a lot like the old man, I have to tell you. The song was called Turn Off the News and Build a Garden. And, you know, that makes a lot of sense because we do get a lot of despair through the news. It's the same story, right? It just gets recycled. The names change, maybe, and the dates change, but the same processes seem to be at work over and over and over, and we're just on this hamster wheel going round and round, wondering how we can possibly get off. So sometimes, not always, it's important to listen to the news and get updates, especially local news. But a lot of the national and international news, I believe, is manipulated and it's fraught with errors of omission and fakery and so forth. And it can wear you down. And so sometimes we need to decompress, so turn off the news and then focus the attention on, well, Lucas Nelson talks about building a garden, which you can do. Sure, grow a garden. My mother-in-law talks about gardening as therapy. She likes to go out and, you know, take some pruning shears and do a little weeding. It's therapy for her. So building a garden is good. Also, just doing good works. Volunteer, especially at Christmas. We had an ad running, or a promo, a PSA rather, running earlier in the program for the Scott Mission here in town. Who have been around a long time. I think it's going on 100 years, 70, 80 maybe. I could be wrong. I got the envelope in the mail, and we threw in a few coins to help buy some Christmas dinners for the needy. But it's those kind of little things that you can do to fight back, really. Kick holes in the darkness, light a candle, don't curse the darkness, all of that. I know those are cliches, but it's true. Good works. Even if we, at this time of year, because our minds and our hearts tend to be focused on doing good works, it should happen all year round, I know, but we tend to think about it, I think, more at Christmas. At least I do. I'm guilty of that. But sometimes it's important to try and take on even more than you think you can manage in terms of trying to alleviate suffering in the world. That's ultimately, I think, how we win. That's how we fight back. Turn off the news. Build a garden. Phil from West Virginia is on the air. How are you, Phil?
Well, thank you, Richard. I'm doing well. I taught physics for 40 years, so when I heard your China fusion news, I hope something comes out of that. I believe cold fusion was suppressed, which is very sad that technology is often used against us instead of being used for us. So
now, hang on, let me ask you something. Since you brought up cold fusion, and of course, Pons and Fleischmann supposedly figured out how to achieve cold fusion, and then it was later, as you say, suppressed. It was stated that no, they didn't achieve it. They sort of went back and forth on that. So you're saying that Pons and Fleischmann did in fact achieve it, and it was suppressed?
Yes, I believe so. I don't believe they totally understood what was going on, and that's why they were easily attacked. But there were other people that did variations of what they did in the lab and got more energy out than what they put in. And when you get more energy out, as in this cold fusion news, you've got something that has great potential. So
over unity. Now, yeah. What is you've been teaching, you taught physics for 40 years?
Yes, I'm a substitute teacher now, but I taught high school physics, biology, chemistry, all the sciences.
Right. Did you happen to hear our program last week with Paul LaViolette?
No, actually, I don't usually tune in to this station. I've heard you on Coast, and I don't think things happen by chance. I think it was appointed that I was to turn this on and hear you, because I have something important that I really want to bring to your attention.
Okay, I'm going to get you to hold on, and if I can, just hold on, because I want to hear what you have to say. We're going to take a time out here, and we'll get back to Phil from West Virginia. Beautiful state, by the way. I took the boys on a baseball road trip down to Cincinnati, and then we went to Pittsburgh, but we drove through West Virginia and Wheeling, West Virginia. Beautiful, beautiful state. I want to go back there sometime. Anyway, Phil from West Virginia, physics teacher for four decades, has something important to tell us, and we'll get to that call right after this. My name is Richard Serrett. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Providing the evidence and letting you draw your own conclusions. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Just a reminder, my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited, it drops 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and you can subscribe and listen at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. All right, back to Phil from West Virginia, physics teacher for 40 years, who has something pressing to tell us. Phil, go ahead. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. I was listening to Paul Williams, and I sensed the desperation both in his voice and in your voice. In other words, what can we do? And I thank you for saying that there is hope and that you have to do something. So I'm just going to give you a touch of what I have here that's important for everyone, especially in America, but there are repercussions for people in Canada also. And that is that after a 5-year legal battle, I have an arbitration award, which is a permanent injunction against the federal government. We ask them to show their authority to do many of the things that they're doing, which we know there are no constitutional authorities. And when they wouldn't answer, we took it to arbitration, and we have an arbitration award, which, like I said, is a permanent injunction. And it was filed on behalf of all American people. In other words, it's kind of like a class action suit or a qui tam. And so at this point,
injunction against what, though? What does the injunction prevent the government from doing going forward?
Well, the injunction is an order, and it's an order for the federal government to provide remedy and relief because they were found to be in violation of the contract, which is called the Constitution. So, like I say, we took it to a third-party independent arbitrator, which is something that is lawful and legal, okay? As a matter of fact, it was just recently upheld in the U.S. Supreme Court, and Kavanaugh wrote the decision. It goes back to pre-biblical times, and even Solomon was an arbitrator when the two women went to him, saying that a child was, you know, each claimed ownership right. of the child, and of course he acted as an arbitrator. Or people go to someone sure. like Judge but Judy. And
Phil, what does this mean, though, in practical terms? People listening saying, okay, so what does this mean, really? What is it? So what's the result of this?
The result is that those who opt in, those who actually believe that the government should be held accountable and have this injunction, can actually exercise relief from it. They would have immunity from the government, since the government wouldn't have a legal means to control them. In other words, when there's a contract, when you have a contract with someone and the contract is broken, you can offer a new contract. And that's what we actually did. And the arbitrator agreed that the contract that they had was breached and that our contract was lawfully submitted, and the government didn't argue the point about our contract.
So what is your contract with the government? Does it have anything to do with income tax?
Yes, it does. Income tax, land ownership. It provides land patent ownership for land. It's like this, Richard. If a ambassador or someone who has a diplomatic immunity comes to this country, they are not subject to the laws of the country because they are not party to the Constitution, you see.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So there is a dedicated website that I wish you and people would look at, because every American has the opportunity to opt in. 1,500 okay. people plus have. And the next thing will be a settlement for enforcement, which will be done in Congress. Starting in January. So it's just an option for people who believe that government should be held accountable. And if government doesn't live up to their side of the contract, then you actually have the legal, lawful right to offer a new contract. And we did.
So you have 1,500 people who have what, basically opted out and are no longer paying income tax? Is that the idea?
Well, that's what will happen with when the award is settled in either the U.S. legislature by a bill on the private side, or by an executive order that we are giving Trump. We're giving him the opportunity to do it by executive order, but it can be done by the United States legislature for remedy and relief.
But Phil, what happens if 300 Americans, well, tax-paying Americans would be what, 100 and however many million Americans pay taxes? What if they all opt out?
Well, this puts the government on notice, and I would like to see them clean up their act so that I could contract with them. You follow me? In other words,
yeah.
There have been 18 unconstitutional wars since I was born in 1950. Now, for me to fund the government to have unconstitutional wars, that's actually, I think, pretty immoral, isn't it?
I would agree. I would agree.
Or for me to fund
I think most aspects of income tax are immoral, quite frankly. It's coercion.
As a matter of fact, income tax is not even constitutional.
Okay. Yeah, I have heard that argument. Do you want to give us the website? Do you want to give us the website,
sure,
Phil?
Sure. The website is HUDOK.info. HUDOK.info. It's a dedicated website for the 5-year battle and the final fruition that we had. So please take a look at it, Richard, and I would love to do a show with you sometime.
Are you the do you have a contact on the website where we can reach you?
Yes, there is a question and email that you can send questions to. So just direct it to me. I'm Phil Hudock. So you can direct the question to me, and then that's how you can get to me, because I don't want to give out my phone number.
No, understood.
Yeah.
Well, Phil, I'll be in touch, because I would like to drill down a little deeper on this and maybe certainly get you on the podcast in the short term. And then who knows, long term, who knows? The sky's the limit. All right, Phil.
Thank
Fascinating.
You.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye. I'm going to try and squeeze Glenn in from our nation's capital. Glenn is in Ottawa. Glenn, good morning. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show.
Good evening, Mr. Stark. Thanks very much for taking my call. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
A little off topic here tonight, I'm afraid. I'm 63 years old, and I wanted to get something off my chest. I guess it's concerning disclosure. When I was 15 years old, I had a sighting. I was with two other people. And when we returned to my home, of course, we were pretty excited. And we started explaining it to my parents, and they laughed us out of the house very quickly. So I learned to keep my mouth shut. And I was able to keep a top secret clearance for most of my life. But I've never told anybody about what happened that night. And this sighting was up close and personal. There was no question about what we had seen. And, Richard, if it ever happens to you, the first thing that will come in your mind is, this is not of this earth. I don't know how long I'm, you know, going to be around, but I just wanted to tell you what happened. And the question remains in my mind, you know, this issue of disclosure, we discuss it. And, you know, Richard, we have the Americans, we have the Canadians, but what about everybody else in the world? Wouldn't someone come out and say, yeah, guy, the gig is up?
Well, people are starting to say the gig is up, and the Navy in the United States is kind of being dragged a little bit, kicking and screaming in that direction. Now they have this other, this new protocol for their Navy pilots where it's easier for them to report these sightings. And of course, we are seeing some major movement with the media as of December 2017 in that New York Times article about the Advanced Aerial Threat Assessment Program. So things are moving. Actually, relative to other years, you might even say at a breakneck speed. Previously, it was at a glacial speed. However, listen, Glenn, I'm sadly out of time. I'd like you to call again. I'm going to do in 2 weeks, the 15th, the 22nd of December, I'm going to do more open lines. I'm going to do another hour. I hope you'll call in and you can tell us some more details about your sighting.
Oh, certainly. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Richard. Much appreciated.
Glenn, thank you. All right. There, that's a date. December 22nd, we'll do another hour of open lines. Okay, well, that is it for me. My thanks to Owen and Ryan, as always. Couldn't do it without you, boys. Gentlemen, I should say. And in the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Or at least up the stairs. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.